Hi everyone, I'm Ben Pearson, former Channel 5 Police Interceptor and West Yorkshire Traffic Cop. But we were in this Subaru, stolen Subaru, which we couldn't catch. We could catch, but we wouldn't catch it because how quick it was going through streets, and there was a certain level of like, we can't do this, this is ridiculous. And then one night I'm on patrol and it came all the way, and about 3 in the morning I saw it, and I'm in VXR, so I'm in a 2.8 turbo. He's in a 2 litre turbo. Mine's a lot more brake horsepower. Mine's faster. And I thought, fuck this, I'm having you. So we had this pursuit around Bradford. And I got him going on a road through city centre. And I think I'm 120 and he's pulling away from me. Then he goes through a red traffic light on the wrong side of the road. I shout, abort. By that time, he's fishtailing down the road. Goes backwards, goes through a bus shelter. And there's a wall, if I go like that, there's a wall. And there's a lad having a few beers, 19.
Welcome to another edition of the Kick Cage, and please welcome Ben Pearson, who you may recognise from Police Interceptors. Ben, how are you?
I'm all right, thank you very much. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Welcome to the show. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here. Fan of the show as well, so yeah. Love the invite and thank you for having me, and hope it's going to be a good one.
My pleasure and honour. Starting off your sort of employment career as a tiller, as a brass polisher, how do we go from that and, you know, selling BMW motorbikes, how do we go from that to being on Channel 5's Police Interceptors as one of UK's premier traffic police officers?
Oh, God. So 47 years old now. So I was a child of the late 70s, early 80s. Every single thing we watched were things like TG Hooker, Chips, all. Anyone probably under 30 won't have a clue what we're on about, but you can find them on TV channels now. I think the Cops TV has them on. But yeah, they're all cheesy 80s TV shows about cops. And it was just a big thing in the early 80s. And it steered me towards that sort of thing. I've always wanted to be an officer. I've always wanted to be part of the police, especially on a police motorcycle. And I've always had that sort of like moral compass. And yeah, I've done a lot of jobs. Like I said, brass polishing, work stacking shells in Saltaire to Northcliffe Golf Club, being a greenkeeper, selling motorbikes, Alan Jeffries. Obviously, other motorcycle dealerships are available. And most of the bobbies, some of those people that came into motorcycle dealership were police officers. It was a time in late 90s, early 2000s, when BMW motorcycles weren't what they are now. They didn't have the following from a long way around, long way up, and all that sort of thing with Hugh McGregor and Charlie Bowman. So there were certain, being honest, a certain stereotypical male that owned these bikes. And it was for your middle-aged, probably someone like how I am now, middle-aged police officer, really, that didn't want to have a sports bike, didn't want to have some sort of Harley. So the majority of people that came in were police officers, and they all, when I spoke to them, they all said I had sort of like the right temperament, right attitude, the right customer focus. As you know yourself, to be a police officer and to deal with that sort of aspect of people, sort of like the problem-solving thing of, I know it sounds simple now when you're talking about it, but when you were young then, right, I can't get my motorcycle on the state. I can get it this state, but I can deliver it there, but we've got a part X. And you're jumbling all these little things together, give them deal. And then one of them were the chief superintendent of North Yorkshire. I can't remember his name. I know it's Tim, but I can't remember his last name. And he just basically said to me, have you thought about applying? Now, the thing with me is I've struggled at school. I'm dyslexic. I'm not very academic. I struggle. When I say now, I really do struggle to read and write. I'm not like cats on the mat wearing a hat eating fish from a dish, but it takes me a while when I look at certain things and people say, well, how have you become a police officer? But again, it's the skills that I've got as a person rather than the academic skills. So yeah, I applied, and then ironically I got an interview which I was blown away at. Then I went for carousel, then I went for medical, then I went for a second interview, and then next thing I know, I got a letter saying congratulations, October 1st 2001, you are now 1965. You'll be stationed at Keighley, and you've got you need to attend at Bishop Gaff for your training, and that were it. Flick a switch, and technically, the rest is history, so to speak.
Sounds a bit of a whirlwind journey just from selling the motorbikes. Now, obviously, on this show, we've heard a lot about military basic training and what that involves. But what does the sort of semi-basic training for a police officer involve?
See, when I joined, we were still doing the what you class as the old school training. It's all completely changed now. We were residential on campus. So we had two weeks at Bishop Garth in Wakefield, their headquarters, and then we went for 17 weeks down Ashford in Kent to their police training centre. Again, 17 weeks residential. If you behave, or if you were good and behaved, you got out at weekend. If you weren't, you had to stay on site. We learned a march. I'd never learned a march before. We did RTC training, but we did a lot of proper end riot training as well, because those were days when it was, there were a lot of Bradford riots. There were a lot of disorder everywhere. So you did the proper style of riot training, proper style of empty hands combat. And then it was just law. And for someone like me, again, who's not academic, I did struggle. But I had a lot of friends that that joined with me that really helped me through the training, so to speak. And at the end of it, you have your attestation, you pass, you get your warrant card. And I can't remember how long it was. I think it was just after 10 weeks. You've got 10 weeks of out on division, and then you go back for another 2 weeks at training school. And it then works in blocks. I think it was 6 weeks on, 2 weeks at training school, 6 weeks on, 2 weeks at training school. And it was just, you were pushed all the time. And obviously, no disrespect to police officers that join now or the caliber of police officers that join now, but everything had to be like, I'm not being funny, a bit like the military service, your boots always had to be bold. Your pants always had to have a crease down. You always, it was the time when we wore the white shirts. They always had to have one line down the sleeve. And I know it's really simple. You can get a few tram lines when you iron it wrong, but you got disciplined. You had no facial hair. It was very, no tattoos. It was very, very, very strict. So you had a level of appearance, and people thrived on that level of being pushed to the limit. And for me, it was the most I've ever been pushed in my life. And now I know regulations that are relaxed now on tattoos and things like that, and fair play to them. We've got to live in a different world to what I joined in. But I think it really did good for me, and it pushed me out of my comfort zone. I think that's what I needed when I joined.
Do you think going from a person who suffered academically with dyslexia, you must have had some sort of confidence issues, I presume, going through this basic training, and having the pride in your appearance, your uniform, learning to march as a unit, did that suddenly give you a wealth of confidence, give you mental resilience to carry on through this?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, being honest, I always thought I were a bit of a player, or a bit of a, how can I put it, a bit of a man about town kind of thing. And then first day when we got to Bishop Garth, you know, when you're thinking, no, I'm not. And it were only at Wakefield. It were only like technically 15 miles from my home. And I'm like, you're just completely out of your depth. You're with people you've never met before. You've all got to get on, different races, religions, backgrounds, different standards of living from everybody. But you've all got to get together and learn how to bully your boots, do your iron, and do all this, do your drill marching. And I started to think, right, if I'm going to learn, I need to be at the bottom of the run at ladder. So I literally just opened my eyes massively, and I just said, right, to people who are ex-forces there, please can you show me how to pull a boot? Please can you show me how to iron properly? Please can you? And I had to literally stand there and say, I need help. But then every time someone showed me something, mentally, I took it all in. And then I'm one of these people, all I have to do is get shown to do something technically once, and I can do it. But if you ask me to read something, I'd read it and forget about it. But if you showed me how to pull a boot and you showed me how to do it properly, it'd just click and I'd be able to do it properly. So my skills then in the police all fell down to, I were the one that had run, I were the one that had technically fight and wrestle, I were the one at disorders. But then when it came to the file aspect, it came to statement taking, everyone knew that I needed help. So I did get a lot of help. Or if I doubled up with somebody, just say like me and you went out on patrol, I'd be like, literally, like, if you want to take statements, I'd really like you to take statements, but I'll stand in front of you and I'll get punched in face first, so to speak. So I'll take that, you do my statement. And most bobbies that I work with were always like, yeah, crack on, feel free. So, and for 19 years, it really did work. But yeah, it made me come out of my shell and it made me grow massively as a person. And put it, I don't think I really said this. At the time, my mum and dad lived in Spain. So and my brother lived in Spain. So in theory, I had no family in England at the time. So when I went to Bishop Garth, I had nowhere to live. I had no home over here. So I was living out of my car, I was living out of hotels, I was living off my mates' couches. So that made me grow. And along with what happened with the police as well and how it made me grow, when we came to pass out, we had to line the driveway of Bishop Garth all in his uniform. And completely different to how I stood before and how I held myself. My mum and dad walked past me and they didn't even recognise me.
Wow.
And it only went, right, mum. And you could see it look in the face thinking they didn't even... I know it's not stupid, you don't slouch anymore, you hold yourself with pride, you walk with pride, and they just walked straight past me and didn't recognise me. And it made me grow massively as a human being, and I loved it. And I'm so proud of what I've done over the 19 years.
Finishing your basic training, I presume that you go on... couple of years of probation, so you're as you would say a beat Bobby. Being on the streets, you do see some horrendous things. What was the first point where, as a police officer, you had to deal with something that could have been quite traumatic for a normal person to witness?
When you go into your probation 2 years, you start to cherry pick jobs, so your tutor starts to give you them. And I remember we went to a lot of Sunday, so my tutor were rape trained, so we used to go to a lot of rapes, and I used to say to her sometimes, it feels like I'm not getting the tutorship that some other bobbies are doing, because some other bobbies were always with what I class as an Action Jackson tutor, and there'd always been fights and there'd always been foot chases or car chases. And I was always listening at radio thinking, I'm at rape again. This is a little bit, I'm not saying boring, but it's like if you're doing rapes over and over and over again, this was the old school rape where you made them stand on brown paper, and it were all different to how it is now. So when I say boring, please don't, if people listen, go, well, it's just flopping this off. I'm not. But when you listen to all car chases and you choose a rape friend officer, you've got to be like for 6-7 hours and you're thinking, I want to get out on the streets and start fighting people. And I remember that when I said that, she started taking me to a load of sudden deaths. Now, a lot of sudden deaths were, when I say fine, they were just elderly people that had died. But the biggest traumatic one at the time, it was something and nothing, but it really got to me, was an old lady that had died at a hospital. She'd been brought in as a resus patient and she died and she was in one of the resus rooms. And I got told to go in and take all the jewellery off and I was on my own. And it just really freaked me out. It just really, really did. It didn't settle well with me at all. And I came out of there and I was shaking. I said, I don't think I can do this again. She went, well, you're going to have to get used to it. And that was really the first one that actually struck a chord with me inside. I said, hang on a minute, there's going to be a lot of dead bodies here. And then I think the main one when I was in tutorship, there were a lot of hangings. They were weird. But the one we were in tutorship was someone who had not been seen for a couple of months, and we went in and it decomposed so bad it couldn't be touched because it just pop in theory. So we had to use shovels and bin bags. So we were just putting bin bags in so that you didn't know which bit were which in a bin bag. It were weird with that. And I think that's one of the main things again that stuck. This is pre-traffic.
Yeah.
So this is technically like there's no RTCs at this point because this is when traffic and they dealt with everything like that. So yeah, it was simple things like that. And I'm being honest with you, they never really sat well. And I think it's I'm personally honest. I think it's because I wear my heart on my sleeve and a lot. And one person once spoke to me and said, "Do you think you've broken the police force due to what you've seen, or do you think in theory when they always say, oh, soldiers, police officers and all this sort of thing, they're all cut from a certain set of cloths. Do you think that in the first place you was not cut from that cloth and you've been in it away for 19 years and it's got to a certain point where it has broke you?" And I don't know, I just think sometimes I've got a big heart and I just think there's some things that humans just should never see or do. And then I think once you've done it for not once, twice, three times, but you're on your 400, 500, 600 sudden death, you're on your 15th fatal involving a kid, someone set on fire, but something inside has got to say, "No, I'm not doing this anymore." It's just hard. So yeah, I suppose they were first ones really, and that did affect me.
Did you get counselling from like your sergeant at the time? Did they sit down and sort of try and decompress you after witnessing these things, or was it very much you've dealt with that? Here's the paperwork, on to the next.
Yeah, there were nothing like that at the time. The only time I did go for something like that was when I was first really, really in traffic, and we went to an horrendous fatal, which were two young lads trapped between they had a 4x4 broke down on dual carriageway, no lights on the road. It was smoking out back of it, so they were all disguised, and it were hit from the rear at 70 miles an hour by transit. So you can understand that they were literally in bits. They had a lurcher dog there, and dog were licking part of the brain and things like that on the floor. And then I won't go into the bump anymore, but about 2-3 weeks later, every night I went to sleep, I saw this lad laid on my bedroom floor. And no matter what, I was awake, how I am now, and I'm looking, and he's laid dead on the floor looking at me. So I went in, and they said I could speak to someone, but again, you just died away. I'm a man. I don't talk about it, especially now I'm a traffic cop or I'm in operational support. I'm being honest with you, that's beneath me, mental health for weak people. And that's how I used to see it all the time before I were seriously poorly, where I should have opened my eyes more. But when you're younger, you're just naive. And that's where, see, it just washes over you. But those days weren't how they were now, with the trauma, the trim, the red arcs and things like that waiting to help you. They weren't there. I think we had Samaritans, but you wouldn't ring them anywhere.
So, experienced that during a beat cop, and obviously you alluded to the point you were in traffic and OSU. At what point did you decide you wanted to move from a beat cop and go to traffic and OSU?
I actually wanted to go to firearms. I wanted to be a knuckle dragger with a gun. The reason being is all my friends that I joined with at the time, after the 2 years, they applied for firearms. And ironically, they're still in now. They're part of the ACT team, which technically, people that I don't know, it's like a specialist counter-terrorism plainclothes SWAT team, basically. They go all around England, they train with SAS, then they're still in that now. I thought I'll give it a couple more years, and I ended up going to do some work on drugs team, which I really, really did like. We were smashing windows on cars, pulling criminals out of cars, proper rough and tumble. What you see on TV is old Sweeney type of job. And it was a bit lawless, and it was good fun. And I thought, oh, I like this. And we got into a few car chases. These weren't authorised car chases. These were cars that we'd taken off criminals anyway, and we're flying around Bradford in these knackered old Focuses and breaking laws. And if you went through a speed camera, it never really mattered because the car wasn't registered to anyone because it was a pull car. And I quite enjoyed that. So when I got my permit, I always used to go to certain, when I say rougher states in the Bradford Keighley area, and I had a lot of pursuits. And then ironically, I didn't know this at the time, but the traffic sergeant watching, who were listening to the pursuits. We had Channel 6 then, which was a different channel to what when people listen to this now, they think the radios we've got now, which are like the Motorola little mobile phone. These were a massive battery pack that you carry around with you on your side, and it had this big wire that would come up and wrap around you, and this big antenna, what you'd see basically on the bill, and Charlie Whiskey, whatever, and it was this big rubber aerial that you could pick your ear with. And then we had Channel 6 for a pursuit channel, so we're always listening to. And I had quite a few pursuits. And the superintendent at the time, called Chris Harden at Keighley, a lovely bloke, he had to sign the application off if you wanted to leave the division at the time. And I had an application in for firearms, and it went to his desk, and he went, no, I'm not signing that off. You're staying at the division. If you want to stay at division, then I'll get you into traffic. And rather than work at one division, get qualified, you've got to move divisions. You can stay in your division. You can stay on your team. You don't have to move. Basically, just go from one office into the side office. We'll give you a T5 and a VXR, and we'll train you up. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not going to say fairer than that, can I? I actually wanted to go to firearms. I thought, well, I'm going to get an advanced ticket. I'm going to learn how to do pursuits. I'm going to learn how to do collisions. And no disrespect to anyone, it's the best job. No matter what everyone says about the police, traffic is the best job you can ever get there. It's fantastic. It's literally boys and girls in theory with all the gear, all the toys, and you just get carte blanche to go out there and get the criminals. And it's fantastic. It's brilliant.
So you've been almost headhunted for this by you know, somebody listening to your car chases. What was the type of training that you went through? Because I would imagine it would be very, very strict, because obviously you'd have to hold yourself to a high regard on, you know, the UK roads, in pursuits, thinking of civilians, thinking of other road users, traveling at such high speeds. I would imagine that the training for this is incredibly immense.
Yeah, it's so hard, it's untrue, and it's there's no anyone's better than anybody else. So there's not that in the job at all. But you've got to be, this is really, it's not arrogant to say, but you've got to be better than someone else. So everything you do, the moment you go out and check your vehicle for a vehicle check, you've got to check it within an inch of its life. Where I'm not saying beat officers don't, but the beat officer might just run the car and jump in car. You've got to check it. You've got to check all your kit. Your office is now in your car. So everything's got to be 100%. These are the days when we weren't wearing combats like we do now and black tap vests. These were the days where we didn't wear a stab vest. We had a white crib shirt on. We had shoes on rather than combat boots, and we had slacks on. We were proper, what you'd expect the old world traffic cop to be in the 80s and early 90s kind of thing. This is how bad it used to be. So you used to wait for a job to come out, which never came out. It was classed as dead man's shoes. It was so rare they ever come out. So that you'd have to wait for the job to come out. You might get 500 people applying for that job. You've got to go for the interview, then get that job. So you've got to be the best person that they think, right, we'll train this lad up. Then when you get in, you've got to go, this is how bad it is, you've got to go on three separate law courses, and each law course were 2 weeks long. So you had to do a two-week law course, pass an exam, and you had to get like 95% or above. Failed it, you're off, you're back to beat. Then you come back, you had another two-week law course exam, passed it, you were on. Then a three-week one, a couple of weeks later, pass it, you're on. All getting about 95% or above. Once you've got that, you've got 2 years, and they'll train you, and you'll be in for about another 8 months, and then you'll go for your advanced driving course, which is 4 weeks. And people say, oh, advanced driving course. So if I give you an impression of how hard that is, if I said to you, do you remember when you passed your driving test? Remember the hour you had for your driving test? And it was like, you were hour not steering wheel, you were sweating. It were hard work concentrating, and you couldn't let your vehicle go 31. It couldn't go 29 in the 30 zone. You've got to do that, in theory, 8 to 10 hours a day for 4 weeks straight. If you go, right, you're in the 30 limit and you're going at 35, you get a warning. This is how it was. Going again 35, right, you're off. You're binned off course. If you're binned off course, you only got one driving test, one driving course. You've binned off your course, you're out of traffic. So everything you just worked for, all your law courses, all the interview, application form, and the 8 months you've just worked before, you're back to beat. And you went to back to beat somewhere where they needed beat officers. So you might be based at Bradford, you might live in Bradford, but they might send you a Wakefield 17 miles from your home. It takes 2.5 hours to get there because they need a space at Bradford, at Wakefield. So the pressure on you were immense. So everything they were doing, from how you parked the car, how you washed the car, how you filled in the book, your mileage book, everything were watched from point A to point B. And it's not now, it's a different world now. It were watched, and at the end of it, you did your advanced course. You went for about a 3-4 hour drive with an instructor who weren't your instructor, was someone else's instructor. And if you impressed them, they signed you off. If you got signed off, you went back to division, then you come back in a couple of weeks, you do your TPAC, which is another week or 2 weeks course. Then you had a 2 years to be signed off then. And if you muck up in those 2 years, you're off. And the pressure is, because then what gets me, really winds me up about stuff, is people go, well, I've seen you drive and you can't drive. I could have caught him. How could you catch that person? If I'm in a high-powered car and I'm doing everything that you're trained to do, the only thing you'd do is you'd do something completely illegal, completely dangerous. You'd have a crash or you'd kill someone. That's the difference. And people say, well, yeah, but I want, well, you can't. I could say I could be an SAS sniper. I could jump out of a Chinook somewhere, jump from 15,000 feet, and I could have shot Bin Laden. Yeah, but you couldn't. Yeah, I could have. I'd have got a Glock and just shot him. Yeah, but you wouldn't have done it. You can't. Just because they've done it doesn't mean you can do it. And you can watch whatever. People can watch whatever they want, say whatever they want. But there's only two people that know what it's like to be in this pursuit or to drive like. One's a traffic cop. One's the burglar in a stolen car. Unless you've one of them two, you will never understand what it's like, because we're doing Do you want me to carry on here?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Right,
yeah.
So we're doing, and what? So I've said to people, right, understand this then. Think about an area in your city centre at 30 mile an hour, busy city centre. So I'll take you through there at rush hour traffic at 80 miles an hour, and you've got to drive exactly how you do on your driving course or on your DSA approved course, 80 mile an hour through rush hour traffic. Not only that, you've got to do your full comms, extra Romeo 5.2 vehicle is now failing stop. It's left on the side of the road. We're coming to Princess Street. We are right at Princess Street, so on and so forth. Not only that, you're looking at your colleague who's a probationer, he's only got 10 weeks in job. Not only that, you're thinking about your vehicle dynamics on the road, how it's handling. Not only that, you think about road traffic law, what exemptions have I got, what can I do, what can't I do. Then not only that, you're looking at his driving, what he's breaking, what exemptions he's breaking, what road traffic, and then you're looking at the risk factor. Not only that, you are now speaking to 10 other traffic units that are in the area. Can you put up on Percival Street, extra Romeo 5.2, extra Romeo 5.3? Can you come on Carlisle Road, please? Not only that, you've now got extra 99 above you on a different channel, shouting up extra 99, we're above you now, filming with downlink on. And then also you go, so you've got to do this on your driving test at 80 mile an hour through 30 mile an hour limit. And you say you can do that with no training and no experience. And I took 19 years to be at the level I got. And people still look at you and go, I could have done that. Yeah, like, fuck off, you could.
By the sounds of it, not only is the testing extremely stressful, but the job must have been immensely stressful.
Yeah.
How do you think that level of stress, let's look at it just for the training process itself, how do you think that level of stress impacted you mentally and physically?
If you're looking at that, at the time, I was buzzing because I was young. I had no other issues apart from work and I was job pissed, basically. And I was buzzing, read everything I did. But the scary part is, and the stress part was the fact of, this is my dream job. And it's equivalent to how I say is, if you're in One Direction and you're going to go for a £10 million contract, you get on stage and all you've got to do straight away, Simon Cowell says, right, I want you a B flat with your note. And you're like, fucking hell, there's a million people looking at me here. I've gone nationwide. And it's that one mistake. It's that one little issue and you're off. And that's what caused you a lot of panic, a lot of pain, a lot of stress. But then when you come back and you are at division, then you're still working with the beat bobbies, the team, but you've always got to be that little bit crisper. Your uniform's got to be a bit crispy. Your boots have always got a bit shinier. Your car's always clean. It's always backed out. So you've got to come on duty an hour before other sets of lads come on team to get your car ready, to get them all, make sure gears in back. And it's just a constant roller coaster of, it's not just turn up, getting car set off. It's everything, and it puts a lot of anxiety on you.
Yeah.
Especially when you're getting in a car, then when a job comes in, you literally walk into office, job comes in, you want to have time to check your car. So you think, right, do I take a car out now and I've got to drive 155 mile an hour down motorway and I haven't checked the tyres? And you're doing it and your heart's pumping, and you're stressed, and you get to the job and say it's a fail. Now I'm thinking about this fail. I'll be working 12 hours. I won't get a meal break. I'll deal with this fail. There'll be a body on the road that I need to sweep up, get rid of, do what we do, run the file, put the telexes out, do everything we do, notify the family. You've not mealed. You've not had a piss in 12 hours. You get back to Nick. Next person comes to get your car. Sergeant, there's a scratch on back at car. PC Pearson, can you come here? Yeah. Hello, what's up? Scratch on back at car. Well, I haven't done it. I've just all done responded to this. Well, did you check car before you went out? No, because I'm due at 7. I came in at 6:15 and I got turned straight out from this other team. And I went, well, it's not good enough, is it? Right, your name's going to book for a discipline. And you're like, what the fuck? And that's what it causes. It causes that. And hang on a minute, I'm trying to be best at bestie. I'm trying to be the best I can. You should have checked your vehicle. So next day, I come on duty. You say, extra Romeo 5.2, we've got a knockdown M62. Can't go to that. I'm checking my vehicle. Then there's all 19 there that I meant to finish at 7 in the morning, having to turn out to do a 24-mile blue light run and won't get back until 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock in the morning. And you're like, am I going to be that guy? Am I going to be that guy? And you think, no, I'm not. So, again, back to that anxiety level. Yeah. And no matter what people say, special forces, soldiers, everyone, they rely on the kit. Everyone relies on the kit you've been given and the kit you've got. And you're hoping it's going to last you and hold out. But sometimes things go wrong, and it's, if you're in it, you're using it, you're doing it, you get the blame. Doesn't matter who's had it before you, doesn't matter what it's, what they've done. And you hope, and you're coming in, you're thinking, all right, I want to do my best for the job, I want to do my best for West Yorkshire, and best for West Yorkshire Police. But then someone ends up dropping you in shit because they haven't reported scratch on car, and you're just trying to do a good thing. And that's where all the grounding builds up. And I think Traffic Bobby's put himself under far too much pressure. It got outlined to me once that one Traffic Bobby said to me, he says, don't forget, for every right and wrong decision that you make in this office, you'll be holding brass rail and going to prison and going to court, and you lose your house and everything. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you're in a pursuit, you get it wrong, someone dies, you go to prison. You go to a file or a fight, you lock someone up, you get it wrong, they get miscarriage of justice, you go to prison. So for everything you do right or you get wrong, just think it'll be you holding brass rail. There's no one else chasing vehicles through Bradford at 130 mile an hour. You are. There's no one else doing wrapping cars around lampposts. You are. No one else doing RS4s making from burglaries. It's you. And an RS4 making from a burglary or a Golf R is not going to go 24 mile an hour. It's going to go as fast as it can go. It's only going to end up one way with them wrapping around the tree. You've got a prison. You lose your house. And so you think, fucking hell, now I've got to do my car. And now I'm coming in and have a job. I'm going to go to prison.
Again, I would imagine that is, it's laying the foundation for something quite serious within yourself. It's laying down some serious stress, worries, anxiety, thinking about the consequences of your actions on a daily basis and thinking what the possible outcome could be. That must have weighed heavily upon you.
Yeah, it's so there's one job. I don't know if you've read one of my books or anything like that, you've heard it, but there's one job we had a pursuit with through Bradford. So it was this lad who was going down doing carjackings and robberies. He was an amateur boxer. And when I say amateur, we're up there, we're going to turn professional. Strong lad, young lad, about 21. You're pulling people out of cars and just women stacking, braying them, nicking their handbags, nicking the cars, doing stuff. Proper pissant coward. But we were in this Subaru, stolen Subaru, which we couldn't catch. We could catch, but we wouldn't catch it because how quick it was going through streets. And there was a certain level of like, we can't do this. This is ridiculous. And then one night I'm on patrol and it came all the way, and it about 3 in the morning I saw it, and I'm in VXR, so I'm in a 2.8 turbo, he's in a 2 litre turbo, mine's a lot more brake horsepower, mine's faster, and I thought, fuck this, I'm having you. So we had this pursuit around Bradford, and I'm got him going on a road through city centre, and I think I'm 120 and he's pulling away from me, then he goes through a red traffic light on the wrong side of the road. I shout, abort, abort, abort. By that time, he's fishtailing down the road, goes backwards, goes through a bush shelter, and there's a wall, if I call it that, there's a wall, and there's a lad having a few beers, 20, no, how old were it, 8, I think he was 18, 19, put his legs over a wall like that, Subaru has just come past, cut his legs off. And then lad's in car, ironically, the driver's got a broken neck, this robber climbs out of the car, climbs over the lad, he's just lopped his legs off, then there's a runner through the woods. Now I run after him. I lose him because he's wearing your bestest trackies and your bestest trainers, your Nike Air Max. I lose him, but he's found on his doorstep, can't move, blood coming out of him, broken neck. If he'd have moved his head, he'd have been paralysed. But then he gets treatment from NHS, doesn't he? And he goes in at cells and he gets free legal advice. But he gets sentenced, I think he gets sentenced for 8 years, but his lad's now no legs kind of thing. And I was pursuing that car, and that haunts me to this day. Every day I think about this lad. Every night I go to sleep, I think about this lad. I think about the noises it makes as it's passing over the tarmac sideways. I think the noise it makes when it bends all the metal from the bus shelter. And I remember the noise you were making when you were on the floor, screaming and bleeding out. And again, you're not meant to see what we saw on that night. You're just not meant to see it. And him begging me to help him, thinking, well, I've caused this. Now, you've got to understand we're there to do a job. And do people not want us to do this job? Do they want us just to... If he'd have been driving and pursued into you, crashed into you and killed you and your family, he'd have just run off anyway. So do you want him stopping? Do you not want him stopping? And we've got to go through this in his heads every day. Should I pursue? Should I not? If that lad had died, I could have been going to prison. And I think, well, hang on a minute, I've swore me off to the Queen. I've got divisional awards coming out of my arse for bravery. I put people life away for murder. I roll up every day and I work 80 hours a week. Never done anything wrong in my life. Why should I ever go to prison for this bag of shit that's just cut someone's legs off? But yeah, so that's one of the things that haunts me. And I've got other jobs like that haunt me. And I can't take it back. I wish I could. And I made an arrangement to see this lad when he was back out of hospital, about 4 months down the line. I went to his house. He came out and I was just bursting into tears. And I gave him a big hug and a cuddle. And he just forgive me. It's not your fault, pal. It was his driver's fault. And I cried. And yeah, that's one of the things that just ruined me as a person. But again, I'll never stop thinking about it. And when people say, well, you see you walking around, shout pig over the side of the road, or leave a troll thing on social media, they don't see what we see. They don't do what we do. All they do is, oh, well, I've put a, I'm one of the cops that sees the vehicle for no insurance. But this bloke had robbed numerous people. He'd beat numerous women up. He'd carjacked people. And then, do you want us to do the job, or do you just want us to ignore it and live in a lawless society? So yeah, that's the trauma that unfortunately you start to unravel on yourself with what you deal with.
What was it that made you decide to go see that lad after he'd come out of hospital, and how difficult must it have been for you to pluck up the courage to go see him?
Looking back now, I'm being honest with you as well, I couldn't cope now. If you look back through my career, there's certain, I suffer now with complex post-traumatic stress disorder, severe depression and severe anxiety. There's been certain jobs where the psychiatrist, psychologist and everyone, trauma specialists, have gone back to where it's sort of like aimed and started from. But there's also other jobs that are inside mix, which have gone in together. Looking back, this is one of the first things that's caused me so much trauma. I should have got serious professional help for. But again, being who I was, being in the elite division, you just don't bother. You're better than that. It's for cowards. It's for pussies, blah, 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 blah. But I couldn't cope. I was crying all the time. I couldn't drive past the area. And it was one of the main areas where you would need to patrol. I just kept on thinking about it over and over and over again. What could I have done differently? Could I have bought it sooner? And it was starting to eat me alive and starting to literally kill me from inside out. And then one of the lads on the team, one of my acting sergeants, was the officer in charge of the case. And I basically went to him and I begged him, can I see the family? Does he want to see me? Can I see him? Can I beg for forgiveness? So he's gone to the family and said, Ben wants to see you, the driver of the pursuit vehicle wants to see you, and he wants forgiveness and stuff like that. He can't cope and he can't move on. Now, understandably and luckily, the family said, yeah. Now, if the family had said no, I don't know where I'd be now. I don't know if I'd still be here. I don't know what I'd be doing. But yeah, and then when he came out and he said, I forgive you, and he hugged me, just like, the weight didn't go, but weight lifted, if that made sense. There was still a dark cloud over my head and back of me. So it always feels like something back of my head pushing me down, and it's weighing me down. And it lifted a lot. But then I still saw him now and again. He lived 3 miles from my house. It turns out he's a cousin of one of my best mates, his girlfriend. So they're always, oh, we spoke to so-and-so and he's doing all right. We spoke to so-and-so. So we're always getting drip fed back into my life all the time. But yeah, I think there's a certain bit in your life where you need to have either forgiveness, you need to have understanding, or you need to have closure on certain wounds that have been opened. And this wound's always going to be there, but it's like now it's scabbed over and I don't pick the scab. If that makes more sense to someone like yourself than other people. But yeah, it's still there. Like now, even talk about it, I still talk about stuff. It doesn't bother me. I love talking about the life I've led. But I think there's a certain element in your life when you start thinking, like, again, now I just think, it needed stopping. It needed stopping at the time, and I'm being the my ego. I'm one that's going to be good enough to stop you. It's not like there's other bobbies that were good, and it's not like I were the best. But I were like, no, I'm fucking taking you out here, lad. And if I could have got closer, I'd just rammed him. But I just didn't have that. I had 2 car lengths gap. But it needed something because I just, it went, that was my moral compass. I didn't want anyone else to suffer from it.
Obviously, you know, people recognize you from Channel 5's Police Interceptors. You, being thrust even more into the public spotlights, and not only where you were patrolling, but now across the world as the program was shown. How were you approached by, obviously, it would have been, you know, your senior leadership to appear on the program, and how did you feel about it?
They were already, I think they'd done two series of traffic cops with us. And they'd done one or two series, they'd done one series of interceptors before. And I always said, I don't want to be part of it because I've got a white streak in my hair anyway. I'm highly recognisable. Everywhere I go, all I get is, regardless, fucking pig. I'm in gym, people shouting pig. Everywhere I go, I've got to sit with my back to wall. I've got to always have my eye on the door. My kids can't go to certain places, can't link in with other children. It's horrendous when we're at the level of what we're doing, because we're pushing back on crime massively in area at time as well. We're taking some right criminals off streets. And I'm like, no, I'm not doing this. Now, I work with a guy called Baby Ben on show, and he's one of my best mates. He's my best mate now, kind of thing. And he was a brilliant asset to work with. And I were off, I can't remember what I was doing. I think I was either in court or on my motorbike course. And I was meant to be like Monday night, or Monday late, Tuesday late, Wednesday night, Thursday night. And I went there Monday. And when I came in Tuesday, Ben went, I've been working with an interceptor crew. Because what they do, they come in the office and say, right, who'd want to go on TV? Who want to do it? So you put your names in. Then it goes to your sergeant, right, who's a good lad? Who's this? Who's that? Or a good lass? Who works hard? Who gets the... Who goes to the areas and gets the pursuits?
Yeah,
and gets the big jobs, and who likes to have a fag break and do this, do that, and not really up for it. So my name had been put down anyway of one of the candidates, as long as same with Baby Ben, and I was shooting Baby Ben at the time. He was my aide, and I went, right, well, fine. Do you enjoy it? And he went, yeah. He says, yeah, I'd recommend you coming out. It's just really good fun. And I said, why? He says, the lad in the back's a young lad, and I think he's like 25, 26. And I'm not being funny, good-looking bastard as well. Really muscular, good body, expert in Krav Maga. So fit, it's untrue. I mean, when we were in foot pursuits, he was running past us with camera. It were brilliant, but it was just a right night. You know when you've missed your brother, your younger brother being born? It's that kind of thing. So I says, right, I'll go out with you. Don't film me. Don't talk to me, but I'll be the car, Ben be the voice. So I went out, and James is sitting back, and he says, just to let you know, if you hear a blip, blip, it's basically, it's just a button. So it starts all cameras rolling in car. Yeah. We won't focus on you, but we'll have it on Ben's shoulder. We'll have a camera pointing at Ben, and I'll be back. So whatever happens, you see some, just I've seen that. You deal with what you want to deal with, but we won't film you. We went out, and within five minutes of going out, Nate, we had a pursuit. Saw this car. I went, fucking don't like that. And then beep, beep. And I could hear cameras go. And I didn't even think, chase his car. Dumped it, got out and run, did Ben. We got this lad, sees car, and then he's talking to me in car, and I don't even know they're there. And I'm saying, yeah, we're doing this with seizing car. And he says, why haven't you got that on camera then? And I went, well, I'm not on camera. He says, well, technically, you're letting it camera, your young Ben's camera. And I'm like, fuck. And then next day, he just gave me a camera, mic me up, give me a camera. And I said, don't put, so I think I went out for 3 weeks. Until I felt happy. But every job I went to, I were a bit of a natural, either a thief taker, or took Ben into the area where he could get the good jobs. And that's what they wanted. They want the golden ticket jobs, yeah. The main jobs that you see. And every time we went out, within a couple of minutes, we had a pursuit. And cameraman would always go, when he came in, can we go with Ben and Ben? Get Ben. And I thought, I'm in a bit of a fucking rock and roll place here, so I might as well just crack on with it. The only sticking point is when you do see me on TV and I'm having a good laugh and I'm cheeking, I'm fun and doing this, I'm just dying inside. That's when my mental health for its worst. I was pretending a lot. I was cracking jokes because if I didn't, you know what it says, if you don't laugh, you'll cry. I was covering over a lot of wounds. My mum had died. My dad had terminal cancer. Everything was going wrong. And I've always said this, every interview I've ever done, people always go, oh, what were your childhood like? What this, what were that? Did you have this? Did you do that? Did you get bullied? I'm not being funny, mate. Until I was 20, no, I'm lying there. Until I was 30, 29, 40, 41. I had a fucking brilliant life. I had a great childhood. I had a great friendship circle. We lived in a lovely house. We weren't rich or anything like that, but we lived in a lovely three-bedroom house, semi-detached house. We had holidays in Mallorca or Spain all the time, which a lot of my friends didn't have because they come from council estates and their mum and dad didn't have a lot of money. And all growing up, we had a great party time growing up. I just had a great time. And it was only when my mum died, within you're thinking, hang on a minute, 2 weeks ago, my life was great. And now it's completely, utterly unraveled. Then when it started unraveling, it never stopped unraveling. And to the point where we are now, it's just never stopped unraveling. It's just got to a point where I can hold it from unraveling, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Over the last, say, 4 or 5 years, it's just been, well, no, it's longer than that now, isn't it? 6 years, it's been hell on earth. And I always say, don't judge me until you've walked a mile in my shoes, until you're laid in bed with me at night, crying my eyes out and waking up with night terrors. Don't ever judge me.
As you were saying, you know, while you were filming that series, you were personally experiencing the worst point of your life, but you were, you know, laughing, joking, jovial. You were putting on a mask to fool your friends, to fool the people that's the other side of that camera. How tiring was that for you?
It ruined me. It ruined me. Intercepts were probably one of the best things that's ever happened to me in general. And I'm not saying it were intercepts that ruined me. It was my mental health that ruined me, but it was about that. I couldn't talk. I didn't know how to explain myself to people. I didn't know what mental health was. Again, I thought it was a new bad back. And then, like, when I lecture and tell people now, the signs and symptoms, which are so easy to spot, but no one spots them. No one, because you don't tell anyone. If you talk to people and tell people, my diet's been off for the last couple of months and I don't know why. I'm going to the gym and all I'm doing is feeling lethargic and tired all the time. I'm not sleeping right. And no matter if I sleep 12 hours or 2 hours, I'm always ruined. And you're thinking, like, well, it's either an hormone deficiency or I'm not being funny. What do you do for a job? Well, I've done this, I've done that. My wife's left me recently, my kid's poorly, whatever. Mm-hmm. Right. And then you start breaking it down. Right. So you basically, what you're saying is you've got certain little issues here in your head thinking, and oh, yeah, I haven't thought about that. But no one mentions that to you. You're all walking in an office, all with your tech gear on. Right, who wants BMW? Who wants this? Who wants T5 and throwing keys at each other? Who wants unmarked? Right, let's go out there and smash it. Yeah. And then if you turn around and went, I cried myself to sleep last night. You can imagine the office just going right. Yeah. They'd all look at you and just start laughing. So you don't really say, oh, it's a strange world we live in, I think. Men, we are, just by nature, we're a creature that likes to feel strong. We like to be the hunter-gatherer, but we're a complex creature. And one of the main things we are complex about is mental health and is being able, ability to speak. Now, I'm really comfortable now in speaking about who I am as a person and mental health. I want then. So I can say to you now, hello, I'm Ben Pearson. I've got severe mental health issues. It's gone that bad recently. Last Friday, I've gone back into therapy because I can't cope anymore. It's got to a point where I saw my second therapist this Friday. Mine's a different sort of illness to certain other people's, because what's triggering me off now, again, is the fact that I can't cope with what I've sort of dug an hole for myself again. There's people sending me messages about, just say, for instance, I got a message the other week. On social media, I probably get 60 messages a day through all channels. And one of them, I've just had a baby. I've been fired from work. Baby's problem life support. They don't think baby's going to live for more than 2 days. My wife's just basically said she doesn't want to do me. Can you help me? And I'm like, what the fuck? What do you want me to do about that? I'm like, you need to be really ringing either your GP, Samaritans, Helpline, and his man club. You need to talk to a professional. Then also needs to open black doors in my head. And it's just making my vision go darker and darker and darker. And I always have this analogy of, like, this emotional backpack that I carry with me all the time. And it's always 65-70% full, and it's full with, like, your home life, your family, your health, and then your bills, your house, and this sort of thing. Yeah. And then when something bad happens, it goes up to 80, 90, 100%. And then it gets to a point where I've got to overfill. And when it overfills, that's when you start struggling. You've got no more room to put your emotions in. And I'm thinking, like, can hell, mine's at mine's now at 100. And normally, I wear backpack on my back, put it on my front so I can see, hang on, it's getting full here. Right, I'll do mindfulness exercise, I'll do this, do that. And it got to a point where it was full. And that, even me now, I didn't know how empty it. And I started going, hang on a minute, I'm closing down. And I found myself just want to sleep. No matter what I'm doing, just want to sleep on couch, sleep. And I thought, it's starting again. This is how it all started in the first place. So rather than thinking, all I could see in front of me was this greatness. And I thought, I can't even plan for tomorrow or the day after. I just thought, right, fuck this. So I reached out to a therapist, I need help. Right, got me in. Went in on Friday, spent an hour just literally in tears, just crying to her. She says, yeah, right, we'll get you back in, you're ruined again. And I think there's just so much, because it's complex, PTSD, yeah. There's just so much that needs to be dealt with and uncovered. And it's not an easy task, but I think if you want to make an effort, the only person that can help yourself is yourself. And if you're drowning in a lake or you're drowning in the sea or a river, if you don't put your hand up and shout, I'm fucking drowning, help me, no one's going to come to your aid. You're just going to go underwater and disappear, aren't you? So I'm lucky I put my hand up. Someone heard me and I'm seeking help, which is it's good. But you really can't see my eyes with the bright red because of the amount of crying and rubbing that I'm doing. I do apologise.
No, I don't apologise. Before we talk about a few elements in that, let's just circle back to what you were saying about being in that crew room, having the keys thrown to the T5, the BMW. It's a very alpha male environment. And like you were saying, you're not going to be that person that's going to turn around and say, I cried myself to sleep last night because of what I witnessed on shift yesterday. Having that alpha male environment, having that stigma of, you know, having to be the man in the room, do you think breaking down those walls, getting rid of that stigma, so it's opening up for people to talk about their experiences, what they might have experienced on the past shift, and talking with their peers and saying, well, actually, yeah, I've been through the same thing, I felt the same way, breaking it down and being able to talk. Do you reckon if you would have been able to do that back then, that would have helped you?
Yeah, I mean, I sometimes wish I had a magic button where I could take me now back then. Then I'd be, right, I'm going to start a mental health thing up on team. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And this is the reason why. It's only once you've been through it, you understand how it demolishes your life. So like, literally having to ring the bank, can't pay the mortgage, I'm not getting paid from work. Right, we might be repossessing your house. Fucking hell. A couple of weeks earlier, I was working and I had money in bank and now I'm struggling to stay afloat. Then you start looking at your missus and she's thinking, can I'm going to believe in you soon? I'm going to take kids. And you're then walking around B&Q looking at ropes and finding a branch that'll hold you up. I was sitting on the edge of Bath naked once, bath full of red hot water. I had a knife to my wrist. Thought, fucking just do it. I've had enough. No one's going to miss me. I'm a burden on everyone. Just fucking do it and go. I think there's a point now where, and this is not me, I've not done this, but since I come out and I wrote the first book, that's been a worldwide success, is that. So that's sold worldwide. It's sold in every country. You can go on list to where it's sold. I'm thinking, sells in Indonesia. Who the fuck reads that in Indonesia? It sells in, where else did it sell? It's just somewhere really bizarre. And you thought, eh? Do you know what I mean? So yeah. It sells in Canada, Australia, America, Russia, Kyrgyzstan. I didn't even know you could go to Kyrgyzstan. It sells there. And then the amount of Bobby's special forces soldiers that message me saying we've read it. So I don't know if it's because of the reputation I had of being on, because Intercept is shown in States, shown worldwide. And then the books followed kind of thing, and the social media with the YouTube, which again is watched worldwide. And you just start thinking, like, as it started something. So the amount of, I've had some Navy SEALs contacted me, people in special forces in SES have contacted me. And it's sort of like opened a door to say, people say, look, I am struggling here. Now, how much it works on shift, I don't know, because I'm not on shift. For all I know, they could be just sat there taking piss out of me. They could have a poster up on the wall and be throwing darts at it with my head on it. But the positive response I've got from officers all over the UK saying, we've read your book, thank you for speaking out about mental health, thank you for doing that. The amount of lectures, I think there's Sussex, Police Scotland, Cumbria, and I think that's it, who I've not lectured to about mental health. and have taken things on that I've said about the mental health aspect. I've been told that one of my videos is used in firearms training, now it met. So the awareness is getting out there. So I'm not saying it's because of me, but I'm saying it's like because I did break a bit of a mold, first of all, I hope that has added to the level of the pushing, if that makes sense. I think we're in a world now where 10 years ago, rainbow laces, pride badges were just coming in and people were like, "What? Why are you wearing that? Oh, it's pride. Well, what's pride? It's this, that, and other." And now that's acceptable to have a pride badge on. It's now acceptable for a Bobby to go to pride. I think this is where we're going now, where we 5 years ago weren't. And I think in another 5 years, I think personally that the mental health thing will be like, I've not taken that off for a year, probably a year now, me and this man club bracelet. It's now getting to that point where everything is recognizable. And this man club with Lou Campbell, it's not getting stopped. We donate money to all sorts of charities now. We've just done a charity for PTSD 999. So we've spent a load of money getting a load of people. I can't remember. This is through ambulance, fire, police, and RNLI to come on first aid mental health courses. So they can see the signs and symptoms, and it's sold out instantly. It's our course, we pay for it, we promoted it, it's sold out instantly throughout UK. So it is getting there. The only thing that pisses me off is we're not recognised, or I'm not recognised, and what we're doing is not recognised by certain people. You're not in the clique. Yeah. And if you want to be in the clique, you've got to abide by their rules and their things. I'm not saying like the Police Federation, but you've got to abide by certain things rather than be a rogue element of it. But we'll only deal with you if you're X, Y, and Z. And no, I'm not cooperating myself or anybody else. So I am me, and I've succeeded in the last 3 years by folding myself out of the norm. Like, you know, I'm not doing what I'm told to do. I'm doing what I think's right. And I think that's the difference. Sometimes there's doing what's right and there's doing what's easy. And I think they're completely different things. And I'm trying to do what's right for other people. And for Bobby's emergency service workers that I've never met before, because I don't want anyone else to feel the way I felt, to struggle the way I did, and have nowhere to turn. So yeah, if that answers your question a little bit.
That absolutely does. If I can take it back to 2020 and when you were medically discharged, what did you look like to yourself in the mirror at that time? What did people around you, your loved ones, see? And how did those two images differ?
Yeah, so I'll take it from my partner. My partner recognised it. Millie recognised it straight away, that I was poorly. People used to see, before I was poorly, sorry, before I retired, people used to see a shell of who I was as a person. Every time I looked in the mirror, I hate what I saw. I was disgusted with myself. I were a failure as a man, as an officer, and as a dad, especially with the contemplating and being on the side of the suicide aspect, because you never should leave your kids. And with them, with that thought, like, that look what my daddy did, and he left us. And then that breaks me out now, because if I lost my kids now, or that my kids were taken away, so to speak, from me, or I were taken away from them, it ruined me. But I've had friends come around and say they saw a broken person, and I was one of the people that they never thought break, but I did break. I think it was challenging for everybody. It wasn't easy for not only my family, but people around me, because how I were acting anyway. But they all knew I were poorly. I wasn't taking the piss. They knew I wasn't with my bad back. You know, I was laying in bed for weeks, couldn't get out of bed. Just didn't want to eat, didn't want to socialise, didn't want to know, didn't want to talk, didn't want to answer texts, didn't want to be on the earth. It felt easy if I had gone. And it was just a horrible, looking back now, it was just a horrible, horrible feeling to have in myself, because just imagine, this is where I look at stuff, just imagine if you didn't have the infrastructure that certain other people have. If people didn't have the life I've got, the family I've got, my brother who loves me dearly, Millie, the kids looking after me, certain few select friends that are calling me every single day. Some people just on their own. They're in a bed sit on their own. They're in a flat on their own. And you can see why they just take their lives, because there's nothing at the end of this dark tunnel, and it just gets darker and darker and heavier and heavier. Luckily, I had the support I needed, but yeah, it's hard when you look at yourself and you realize how much you've failed in life, and only over a short time, where you think sometimes it could take tens of years, and it can just take months. And that's what really hurt at the time.
It's easy. As soon as something significantly bad happens in your life, it's easy to concentrate on everything bad at that time. You only start to see the bad that's happened previously, that's happened to you at that point. The hardest part is to see what good is happening at that point. And that's what sometimes can drag you away from that feeling. Or just having that text message from a friend who might notice that you're not yourself, just saying, "Hi, mate, how are you doing today?" That could pull that person away from, you know, doing something completely life-ending.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. So what's happened since I've got out of the place, there's been a lot of negativity with some people that I used to work with. I won't go into it, but if I can cope, why can't he? I do the same job. Why is he done this? Well, it's not happened to me. Yeah, it's not happened to you yet, but you haven't switched your mum's ventilator off. You haven't gone to a decapitated 2-year-old 2 weeks after your mum's funeral. First day back at work. You haven't held your dad's hand and laid with him. If you've watched him over the last 6 months, just die of terminal cancer and he dies in your arms. You haven't done what I've done, so don't ever think that it won't affect you, because when your mum and dad, that happens to you with your mum and dad, and that happens to you, you will go, you will break, because we all know that death's horrible. And when you lose a parent or a loved one, it's horrible. And then ours, mine happened within same year. And it were part of the journey. But what I've done since, I've got a lot of those negative people out of my life. I've defriended them because all I've been told is what they're saying. And I thought, even if it were bullshit, and I'm not bothered if it is bullshit, but even if it were bullshit, negativity fuels negativity. And instantly, as soon as someone says, "Oh, have you heard what so-and-so said?" I don't want to know, because now you're making what we're talking about negative.
Yeah.
So what we do is just don't talk about that aspect. I don't want to know, and make everything that you bring into my life as being positive. Because if you're not bringing something achievable, positive, or something that's going to make me, you, or someone around us smile, what are we doing it for, and why are we here? So there were so many people that were, how can I put it, friends with me just because I were a traffic cop. There were so many people that were friends with me because I'd been on TV, or there were friends that were with me because they knew either my brother or they knew someone else. And then literally you go to your Facebook one day and you've got, say, 900 friends. Then you go the day after and you're down to like 233 friends, and you realise, yeah, you've all turned your back. Mm-hmm. You realise who your friends are, and you realise who the ones that will come for you when demons are there at night. So what me and my friends do now, I've got a great selection of mates around me, all still from childhood mates, some that I have worked with, Baby Ben and others. And then, like I said, you can count the best ones on 5 fingers. And all they do is surround you with positivity. When they see you, yeah, they still talk about work, still talk about jobs and fails, but they don't do it as a negative fatal incident. They do it as it's a positive. We've done this. We had an arrest from it. We've gone prosecuted. We've done this. We've looked after. And it's a positive story rather than something negative, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I don't want the backstabbing. I don't want the lies, the deceit. I don't want the pain, horribleness. It's just life's too short. And when everyone knows life's too short. So my thing is just try and be good, try and be positive, try and spread happiness. And that's all I try and do.
I mean, you're doing a wonderful thing, you know, breaking the stigma of the alpha male who's been in such a high placed job in UK police, of, you know, speaking about mental health and emotions. And that one thing I've found with speaking with American veterans, America seems to be so far ahead when it comes to mental health. Tying mental health in with hormones, I think, as you alluded to earlier, having testosterone levels checked. Again, a man having to go to the doctors and say, "Oh, I want my testosterone levels checked," can be a huge confidence thing. And they might not want to do that, but again, having a very low testosterone affects your mood, which affects your mental health. I'm just wondering if that's anything that you might have looked into or researched about or even done.
So I've not been, ironically, I've had my prostate check though. I've had that magical thumb, and that were a life lesson. I've not been, but I have been researching it recently.
Yeah.
Let's be honest, we're not getting any younger, and I'm 47 now. And one of the main things I do look at, I'm back at the gym, I'm back training. One of the main things I do look at is the fact of my energy levels and my mental, I'm going to say arrangement. So the thought process of going forward, short-term memory, names, no chance. I can't remember names. And I thought, fucking, have I got Alzheimer's here? Or have I got, what's the other one? Begins with D. This is how bad I am. But dementia. Yeah. Have I got this? Have I got that? And I start worrying about it. But the more I look at, the more I research and things, I start thinking, like, I wonder if I've got a bit of a low testosterone level as well. So yeah. One of the main things I do want to do, I do need to get it checked. I've looked at, is it DHT or what, HRT, or whatever it's called?
TRT, testosterone replacement therapy.
Yeah, something like that, yeah. And I've been looking at all sorts of different things because I just think I'm constantly tired. And I mean constantly lethargic, no matter how much protein you want to drink, how much creatine you want to drink, how much you want to go for a run, go for a walk, go to the gym, spend time. I'm constantly tired. And I'm thinking, back to our war before, where I used to say, I'm constantly tired, it's because of X, Y, and Z. Now I answer it and say, right, my mental health is being looked after now by somebody else. My mind at the moment's being my friend. My body's quite fit and strong. So there's something else underlying here as well. So that is a really good thing. Like what we said a bit earlier about certain testosterone levels, and that is a really good thing that I need to do. And I'd recommend it, like you're saying, it's one of the main things that does lead up to depression in certain age men, and how it does function with the fact of it alters different parts of your body. But again, like we said, women go through menopause, as men get older, men can lose testosterone. We all know it can be out of your libido, it can be hair, it can be, I don't have much hair anyway, but it can be hair, it can be all sorts of things. So yeah, I now you've said that, I'm going to go get it checked. So thank you.
And just like you alluded to there, I mean, women, when they go through the menopause, have HRT, hormone replacement therapy. So why is it so difficult for men to admit that they might be going through a bit of a life change, a bit of an age thing, and say, right, well, okay, I need to go on testosterone replacement therapy? How there is still that alpha male mentality still going on, thinking, well, I don't need to get this checked, I'm just going to carry on regardless, and it just ends up in disaster.
Well, I think what you need to look at as well, which I've said to loads of people, is the fact that when proper bodybuilders or gym goers or whatever, they're probably on it. You look at people like Stallone, Schwarzenegger, he's been on it. And then you look at all other people that haven't been on it, and you're thinking, like, well, it's obviously got some good benefits. It's got some good things, because if it improves your libido, it improves your strength, it improves your physique, it improves your hormone levels, it improves most of all your mental health. What the hell is not? If you could put that in a magic little pill, they brought the blue pill out to give you a stiffy, didn't they? The Viagra pill, and people bought it for billions. But if you brought a pill out that went, right, this pill is probably going to give you a better body, better head of hair, better testosterone level, better libido, better this, better that, and you can buy it over a counter, that would sell out worldwide. But it's the fact that you've got to go and you say, I think I've got an issue. And one of the hardest things I ever did was when my mum had died, I waited outside doctor's surgery. And I was looking at my hand, and it's like, you might be able to see it now. It's shake. I was looking at my hand, and I'm rubbing my hand, and I'm thinking, that's fucking shaking there. It's really badly shaking. And then I was looking at my feet, and thought, my fucking feet shaking. And I was just crying. I was just heartbroken. And he sat me down and says, you all right? And I couldn't get any words out. And his words, I'm going to cry in a minute. He says, can see you struggling, aren't you? And I just nodded. And he says, "Are you? Do you think you're struggling mentally? And I didn't need to say out. And I started nodding. And then the more he talked to me, the more I was rocking, and words started coming out. And then within a couple of minutes, I was just saying, I can't cope. I'm this, I'm that, I'm broken, I need help, I don't leave me, I need a cuddle. Fortunately, you couldn't cuddle me, says I can't really cuddle you. But I like, and it was like, as soon as I did it, I like, I want checking. And it was like all the energy, the you know what we call it? Anxiety. Oh God. Adrenaline. Yep. Everything going in my body, it wants to keep me going because I was burning myself out. I was like sleeping 2 hours a night. The body's pumping itself with adrenaline. Anxiety is pounding through my chest. And I had all this energy. I had nowhere to go. I had nothing to do with it. And then as soon as you started talking to me, you could feel these come off. And I was like thinking, like, simple fact, it just opening your mouth just eases so many demons. So what is the problem with it? What is the... But again... Some blokes just do not want to know. Some blokes are just stuck in the mud and they won't want to know. And you can only tell people that will want to listen. You can't make people listen.
Obviously, you know, you've wrote some very successful books and you decided to start doing a podcast. Was that, much as my podcast, as in trying to help others and help yourself at the same time, just listening to their stories and seeing how they can help other people. But, you know, it's also a method of helping yourself at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, the podcast started out, well, there meant to be a podcast before the YouTube channel, but the YouTube channel just turned into be what it was. But the podcast started out because I wanted to sit with people like yourself and chat about stuff. The only downside for me is when I was chatting to people, everyone was chatting to, say, like yourself, they're all people with horrendous stories. And I mean horrendous, like Martin Hibbert, absolutely cracking. If you ever want someone on your show, get Martin Hibbert on. He was blown up at Manchester bombing. His daughter was blown up. She was left for dead. He's paralyzed now, but he's first person to climb Kilimanjaro in a wheelchair for Spinal Institute Association. But you listen to all these stories of like everyone being killed, blown up, shot at Chris Ryan STS, you know, when he's being dropped down with and he's got to do his 200 mile walk and his feet have dropped off in his boots and he's drinking really after water. And I'm thinking like, Canel, he's killing me. So it did ease so many demons in me because what we're doing is I was talking to people and saying, well, so what do you do to cope? What do you do when you're struggling? How do the demons affect you? And then everyone that listened to it will send a message saying, I realized now I need help. I realized I need struggling. And it was brilliant. But like Josh, the producer of it, says there's only so much he thinks I can technically deal with. So the next ones that we're doing, we haven't actually started it yet, but we're getting the plan together. We want to be a bit more lighthearted about it, where we are still having good people come on about their stories. But we're going to be saying, look, you've got the story to tell. We're going to be telling the story, but it's going to be more of a piss take. And I don't mean we're taking the piss out of you, but we're having a laugh like you. Rather than me and you sat on couch now over one beer, this is going to be the lads in the pub over 7 pints. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you're still
going to get the context of information out of them, and there's still the learning development about mental health. But we're going to do it where people can be listening to it in gym, or listening to it in car with family, aren't we? Well, if the kids are old enough, obviously. Because a lot of mine were quite dark, and there were a lot of people revealing a lot of trauma, suicide, and this sort of thing. Where I think what we can do is we can do it now, where we can do it with a light-hearted tint of it, and we're having I want to have like the Hat of Doom in the middle of the table, and then we've just got ideas ripped up, and then halfway through the thing, we pull out something from Hat of Doom. So like you're saying, it might say Flat Earth. So now we start bringing in about me and you talking and what we're doing, but bringing in Flat Earth somehow. Mm. And it's that sort of thing, because you're thinking, wait a minute, I mean, you're an ex-soldier, or you're an ex-sister, you're ex-that. Why the fuck have I brought Flat Earth into it? But then we're going to ask you, from your point of view, what have you seen? So a lot of people that I've spoke to before, like one woman we're going to be having on, she's one of the main pilots for a certain big airline. So ironically, that would have been really good for Flat Earth. So it's not just like we're not throwing it as a curveball to be boring. We're throwing it as a curveball to some stuff will log in at a certain people that we've been. I mean, if you're talking to you now, it's about gummy bears cartoon. It's like, it's not going to really go in this. But if you pull something out and it were about career changes,
yeah,
okay, that would be a good aspect to change into the conversation. So yeah, that's going to be upcoming soon. But everything we're doing, it's literally just always about promoting that person, promoting their health, their life. And one of them, like I said, Craig Harrison. I just feel so sorry for him that he just says, I don't have any friends anymore. So I text him once a week or once a month just saying, look, welfare check, sit rep. And he's like, good away from your pal. And he just says, no one texts me. And I'm like, that's how I felt. And I think, fucking hell, you've got to look after your mates. You've got to look after people that are out there, and especially the ones that have served for you or ones that have done stuff for you. Because I said to him once, if you could take it back, would you still go in? And would I not? And I said, but you could be in pub now. You could be an accountant, being in pub with your mates, drinking, having loads of friends. And do you choose life you've got now? But you don't ever leave your mates behind. You don't ever leave those that are struggling behind. And you always want to know that I've done my bit to make sure they're all right as well. Because I might only have an hour conversation with them, but I think some of the best people I've ever met. And you know that they'll be there for you thick and thin because that's who they are.
Yeah, and you almost share the same situations that you've been through, different paths, but in reality, we've all sort of been through the same personal traumas, the same dark places, and we've managed to crawl ourselves out. So when we talk to these people, we're very much connected in that sort of way. Obviously, you know, you've become very renowned on social media in that, and like you said, you alluded to, you know you get messages from people, and you were on about your bag that you carry, that you put all your worries and stresses in. Asking the question, you know, you must get a lot of messages, like you said, of people saying, I need help, what to do. So this must be filling your bag up on a daily basis when you get these messages. Do they have a negative connotation on your own mental health when you get many messages of that context?
Yeah, massively. Because one of the lads, Josh, who obviously started it all off for me, and my producer, he does loads with a lot of famous people, does Ant Middleton, Octagon, and all sorts of stuff. He's basically advice to me, and it's good advice from where he comes from, is literally turn off your DMs, don't allow DMs, don't respond to DMs, and don't look at any comments. And I think I personally think that's fine if you're Brad Pitt and you don't rely on the public, if that makes sense. Yeah. Where I'm all the way around, where if I didn't reply and he did something, she did something, they did something, and I found out, that would break me. It's that thing of, like I said, with the boy with no legs and the pursuit, I needed forgiveness. So yeah. I won't be able to turn around and say, I've done that. Some people say, I've had a message today, I'm one of your biggest fans, please, 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 can you just reply, it'll make me day. And so I send them things saying, why would I never reply? I'd always reply, hope you're all right, big love, keep smiling. And then you get these things saying, I can't believe you. And I'm thinking, I'm only Ben, I'm only fucking traffic cop. You know, I still pick my nose, I still wipe my ass with the same hand. There's nothing different about me to anybody else.
Yeah.
So again, it's one of those things where I reply because they've taken time to message me, I'll take time to message them. The only thing is, if you look at, you're getting 60 a day, roughly around 60 a day, and then lately my mental health has been shit, I might get through 5. So the next day I've got another 60, the next day I've got another 60, not up to do with all the appointments, the interviews, podcasts as well. like tomorrow I'm filming in Manchester for a new TV series, like all the stuff that's planning for that. And then I've got my own family, so my kids are in there waiting for daddy to come back in. I've got washing out online that I need to get in. I've got to be up in the morning to get ready. It's just you've got to allocate a certain amount of time. And one thing that my partner Millie said, she's the detective sergeant police, she says, don't don't forget your family, don't forget the other people that are around you that are creating this thing for you. And I think there's a certain point of being able to sit down and say, like, say we do this now. But then I'll probably have a quick check on my phone, make sure there's nothing urgent being sent through. But then I won't look at it till probably 8 o'clock in the morning. I'll give myself an hour and 10 tops. But then I'm going to Manchester, so I'll check it on train from Bradford to Manchester. So there's got to be certain areas. And then people, and a lot of people, this really gets me. You're dealing with, when you talk about mental health, you're dealing with people that either have got a little bit of mental health issues, they're struggling massively, or they've got severe mental health issues. And one of the things I found, people want it like that, they want it now. So if they send you a message, but I found this with my illness, if me and you are best mates and I say, fancy pint at pub, send it to your text and it says red, I expect to reply. Not, well, I'm having a shit, then I'm having my tea, and then I'm going to ring you back. Yeah. Well, you've read it. While you've got your phone in your hand, you've read it, I expect to give me a 10-hour reply, not a problem at all. But after an hour, I start thinking, why aren't you replying to me? But then people do it to me. And then I'm like, fucking hell, mate, I'm still on train to, or I've been filming for 10 hours. I'm trying to reply, but I can't just, well, everyone put your cameras down. Put your camera, Barry from Clitheroe wants me to reply to him. So I've got to allocate the amount of time to do it right and to do it fair and then give people back what they give me, because it gives me support and it gives me love when they message me. So I've got to give it back. So, but when it is negative, it does feed off you. And I think that's why I've gone back into therapy, because there is a lot of, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of positives, but there's a fucking lot of trolls, yeah, and there's a lot of negatives that come through. Like one other day, I just says, fucking, why don't you just kill up and die? And you're like, that's just from a person. You've taken time out of your own life to go onto a social media channel and put that. What are your issues? But you don't realise. Now, that comment doesn't bother me. Slag me off, doesn't bother me. But that comment really, really hurts me in a mental aspect, because you just start thinking like, that level you've got to, this chipping away, and you can see the darkness start to come back in. And it's only down to yourself. You're trying to open the darkness back on train, listening to some good music. And so, yeah, it is hard, but I'll never stop caring about people and I'll never stop replying to people. So people that are listening, I will reply.
Time for yourself, having time for your family is incredibly important. Separating it from work, from exercise, and from obviously replying to these people that reach out to you is incredibly important. And having those dividers that separate that is incredibly important to you know, your physical and mental health. If you could take some advice from yourself as you sit here now and give it to that young lad that was there polishing his boots and ironing those creases into his trousers and shirt at police basic training, what advice would you give him?
That's a great question, mate. I'd probably just say, just look, it's only a job. There's a life and there's a job, and you can get a job anywhere. You can get a job doing anything, but it's only a job. Don't let it affect you. And if you did, reach out and speak about the effects that it has on you, because anyone, regardless whether you're a snooker player, a grass cutter or a brass polisher, everyone has got their own demons and everyone struggles. But the thing with me is I was job pissed. Ironically, I watched a film with Chris Kyle the other day. I thought I'd give it another watch with Bradley Cooper, and I fucking loved it. It was brilliant. But it's the point when he has his kid and he's just a rocking chair and he just wants to go back to work and he's job pissed. And that's one of the main signs, like, you're struggling here, dude. You're really struggling. And there's a point when he's in the, that really resonated with me. There's a point when he's in his, I think it's like a post office, and this kid's there, and a man comes over and salutes him, and he says, you saved my life in wherever.
Oh, he's in the mechanics, really, in the mechanic shop having his truck fixed.
Yeah, that's it. And he's really... Did I? Right, yeah. And his kid's there. Yeah. And I'm like, fucking hell, that's how I am. I says, there's no point being job pissed. Even you look up in One Direction or Little Mix, don't be job pissed. It's only a job. And everyone gets to a certain point and goes, no, I'm not doing this anymore. It's only a job. So I always say, when people say a bit of advice, I'll say, right, get in, enjoy it, smile. But remember, it's just a job. People think it's not. People think it's something else. It's not. It's just a job. Don't like it, don't do it.
And one bit of advice that I'd like you to hopefully allude on is, if a partner, loved one or friend was noticing symptoms, changes in a person that they might be thinking is struggling with mental health, what symptoms, personality traits do you think they should be looking out for somebody who might be struggling?
First of all, I'd say that if someone starts to struggle, you'll notice little things in yourself. So one of the main things I've always said is diet. Your diet, your sleep pattern will always change. And with that change, you become tired. So it's a lethargicness. So you'll notice people sleeping all the time. Wherever they're going to be going, they'll be nodding off in car, they'll be sleeping. I'm having a power nap on couch. I don't want to get up in the morning. It's little things that, like that, that start going. But then bigger things are like disassociation, the fact of you don't seem to find things happy or fun anymore. You don't seem to find things like love or companionship. Like with my little boy, Isaac, were born, it was like I didn't want to touch him. So it's little things that you find. One of the main things that I really wish I'd known about at the time is hypersensitivity. So this is a major thing. It's the noises. Noises become amplified and make you jump more. Colours become a lot brighter. The fact that you're more paranoid, you want to sit with your back to the door more, you think everyone's against you. So you'll notice little things that your partner's always wanting to go to so-and-so, then they don't. And it's hard, well, now they're doing this, they're doing that. And it's really, once you be able to think, right, hang on a minute, someone's tired all the time, they're not eating right, they're not sleeping right, and they're becoming irritable, and they think the best mate's being a bit of a dick, and you start thinking, right, there's certain little issues here. And once you spot that, it's really easy. What I'd recommend then is straight to the GP, straight professional. But all I say as well, if there's men out there that are struggling, one of the main things I found and spoke to so many people, hundreds and hundreds of people, is little things like Andy's Man Club. And the amount of police officers, soldiers, emergency service workers, firefighters I know that go and come out and say, it's just good to sit around with another set of blokes, take the piss and say, look, I'm struggling. And I think it's fantastic. So if they are, look at Andy's Man Club. If there's women, I know there's women's clubs out there as well. But yeah, for blokes that are especially struggling, Andy's Man Club, jot to GP and just talk, and you will get there.
Thank you very much for that advice. I'll put some links to Andy's Man Club in the description of the video and the audio. Ben, it's been wonderful speaking to you. You are incredibly open and honest about the struggles that you've been through and that, you know, you are still going through. So from the bottom of my heart, I wish you, you know, all the best for the future. For anybody that is struggling, it is a continued journey and it is a continued fight. So please stay in the fight, and hopefully you'll get better soon. But thank you very much for coming on the show. It's been an absolute honor speaking to you.
Thank you for the invite, mate. I've loved it. Please keep safe and big love.
Thank you very much.